Let's step into roleplay, Jack. What's a common objection that somebody might share with you or you've experienced yourself?
The commitment is too long. We'd never work with somebody for 6 months.
Okay. Read their face, read their body language, and the next words that come out of their mouth would be the most telling piece of information that you have. So when you look for those little tells, these little signs, you'll notice something and you should address it. Just say, okay, I just want to double check because it sounded like you were a little hesitant with that price point. Tell me more about what you're feeling. What were your expectations? I only had $500. Is they price reverse price anchored you right now? So you're sitting there thinking, I want to 10 to 20K. They're saying 500. Maybe I should ask for 1500 now. This guy or gal doesn't give a rat's balls if we work with them. They're not sitting here treating us and blowing smoke up our butt. If you go on that call and you're like all huffing and puffing and hyper-energized and it's desperate to close it, you won't be using all of your brain. You'll sound desperate. And desperate people are pretty repulsive. The CEO asked me personally, he said, Chris, have you been to our site? Do you know what we do? I said, I haven't. I don't. And I'm going to tell you right now, silence is your friend.
Chris Doe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And I was saying to you, you are a very well-dressed man. So thank you for keeping up appearances.
Just pop the collar right there.
There we go. Watch this on YouTube. If you're on Spotify, what's the point? You don't want to be in the ears. You want to see the visual. So Chris, we kick off the same way every time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Well, my name is Chris Doe. I'm a loud introvert, a recovering graphic designer, a serial dreamer, and a first-class troublemaker. The problems that I solve is I try and help people who are in their creative entrepreneurial journey to help them find value in what they do.
Nice. So creative entrepreneurs, typically when you're talking to them, what are the symptoms? Say it was a doctor's surgery. Where do you find them struggling the most?
I can usually tell because they're living month to month. Their runway is very short. They don't have a great relationship with money and value. They love what it is that they do and they're very good at it. And the unfortunate thing is they don't know how to reach out to people. They don't know how to talk to them. And so they wind up self-sabotaging, self-negotiating. And those are usually the symptoms. When somebody says, you know, you could charge more, I'm like, but then I would lose my clients. That's usually the first symptom that you'll find.
Nice. Nice. Chris, nice to meet you. You make us look bad. I know we're talking about how well-dressed you are, but I think it needs to be echoed before we jump into anything.
Just for everybody who can't see this, it's just like you throw on one jacket and the boys are good.
Listen, we're easily pleased or Chris looks really cool. You have to watch and decide for yourself. So let's start from the top then. So one of the things that I've heard you talk about is the idea of selling without selling.
Yes.
What does that mean? Break that down for us.
Okay. Selling without selling, maybe a more refined way to say that is selling without being salesy. We need to sell and we're always selling. We're selling ideas. Like when you're trying to convince your friend to pick you up at the airport, that's an idea. Or maybe there's something you wrote and you want people to read it, like on LinkedIn or in a physical, tangible book, like the ones I haven't read behind me. You're trying to get people to get excited about the idea. And there's a professor at Art Center, his name is Errol Garrison. And he said, for him, selling is like you have an excitement about something and you want to transfer that excitement to someone else. So there's a very broad application of that. The salesy part is the part we usually feel when someone is very aggressive, somebody who's being very manipulative and trying to get us to do something almost against our will. That's the part that we have some problems with. You experience that most commonly at a used car lot or most any car lot, or somebody who's trying to sell you a timeshare. I don't know if they have that where you're from, but my God, they put their hooks in you. You think you're showing up for a free breakfast buffet, which is usually very good. And then they just don't let you leave. They just will not let you leave. They're pulling on all the psychological triggers. And it's very hard to walk away from those. So I just warn everybody, that expression, there's no such thing as a free meal, that's probably where it came from.
So let me ask then, Chris, when it comes to, so you talk about where people go wrong when it comes to the selling, what do you think is the antidote to that then? What should people be doing so that they're not coming across as salesy? What are the techniques, the styles, the methodology, what should they be doing?
Okay. Well, we need better models because if we're looking at the people who are very aggressive, manipulative, and very selfish in the way that they try to get us to buy something, it's going to turn us off and we're going to have a bad reaction to it. I'll give you an example. We have a very fussy water heater. It's an on-demand water heater. And for some reason, every time I take a shower, it starts hot and then it goes cold. So I almost have like PTSD when it comes to my own shower. Everywhere else in the house works just fine. Just in my shower, for whatever reason, as I'm getting ready for this pod, it goes cold on me. I'm like, no. And it's like ice cold because of where we get the water from, I suppose. And so I have a little PTSD, and I'm reluctant to take showers now because I know the cold water's coming. And sometimes it doesn't, and it's wonderful, but most of the times I'm nervous about it. So if we take that as an idea and we say, you know, when we're encountering other people and they sell to us a certain way, we have a really weird feeling. That's that cold shower thing. So that when we talk to someone about an opportunity to work with us, then we have that same reaction. So we have to kind of somehow clear slate, hit reset, and find a new model and find other ways of doing it where we can see people doing it in a very generous way. I would look at it more like a teacher. So if you're in a class that's taught by someone who's very passionate and very skilled at teaching, they're selling you ideas all the time. They're trying to get you to do something that you might not be aware of that's to your benefit. And they lead, if they're a good teacher, with asking really great questions so that you can self-discover. And they do this in a Socratic approach. So it's no coincidence that I'm in a used bookstore and I'm just browsing through the different self-help and business area. And then I come across this title. It's a book called Socratic Selling. I was like, that's an interesting combination of words. Socratic, which I understand, like Socrates, and selling. It's an older book written by a gentleman by the name of Kevin Daly. And in it, he says, if we just ask better questions in a Socratic way, the client who has all the power can find their own way. Excuse me. They can find their own way to their own answers, and it feels more powerful. It feels more like, this is my idea. So our job in the sales process is to ask big, beautiful questions that are open, that are curious, that are not filled with an agenda. And then we learn how to listen and process what we hear. If we can just work on those two key skills, simple to understand, difficult to do, then we're going to be much, much better at this. And I can give you examples, so we can go as deep as you want.
Yeah, please keep it flowing, Chris. Give us okay. Some examples where that would work.
Okay, there's a simple example I saw somewhere on the internet talking about how our brains are kind of wired. So they'll ask somebody, hey, go from A to Z as fast as you can. They'll A, B, C, D, F, G. You can do that pretty quickly. And then they'll say something like, count backwards from 99, 98, 97, 96. But then they said, you know what? Alternate between these two things. A, 99, B, 98, C, 97. And all of a sudden, we really have to slow down because we're focusing on two different things right now, right? So that we don't mess that up. Not difficult to do, but just takes a lot more time because it's a bigger cognitive load. So when you're having a conversation, like I'm having a conversation with you right now, if I'm thinking about lunch or another pod or a presentation I have to do tonight, I'm doing the same thing in my mind. I'm distracted. I'm not giving it the full attention it deserves to be able to listen to you. And this is a very difficult thing. So the first and hardest thing that you need to do is just ask the opening question, which is something like this. Tell me more about why we're having this conversation, or what's on your mind, Jack? I would just open up with something like that. Before I get into my presentation today, I'm curious as to what's a hot issue for you right now as it relates to your business. And then just be quiet for the rest of the time. So if you can get that first open-ended question out and take notes while they're talking, I think you're going to be able to focus and understand what's going on. In the book, Kevin talks about this, where we're really excited about taking the prospect to a future state where we're working together, where they give us money, and we're delivering a great product at the end of it. But before we can go to the future, we must go to the past. We must go back to the future, I suppose. No, that didn't work. We need to go back to the past because something has happened in your life that has created some kind of pain for you. Not physical pain, but stress, anxiety, or concern. I need to go back to that source to figure out what has happened so that we're in the conversation right now that I might be able to figure out a better way for you. These, in sales, it's called the inciting incident. You can only discover them. You cannot manufacture them. So I'll give you an example of an inciting incident. Let's say, for example, you're going to speak at a conference and you're not that practiced at speaking. And so this is causing some pain or stress for you. Now, if I were to have a conversation with you and I was a speaking coach, or maybe I'm a presentation designer, I would ask you, like, what's on your mind right now? And you might tell me about your website, about your social media. And eventually, one of the problems you tell me about might be something that I can solve. And that's it. It's a conversation. It's about discovering and figuring out what's giving you the greatest pain. And you're like, Chris, I don't want to talk about the website or logo or social media. The thing that's keeping me up at night right now is I got a big talk I need to do in 45 days. And it is just, it's killing me right now. I can't sleep well. My body aches. My jaw hurts. I'm feeling a lot of stress. I would say, tell me more about that. What's going on? What's your concern? And then we would discover it together. We would surface the hidden problems. We talk about it. And then I would help you through questions, lead you to some possible solutions.
I love that. And we're very much at the same school of thought, Chris. So one of the analogies I use as well, and I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I also talk about like having a pain and a problem is great. Like that is the first bit that you want to find during discovery, because if there's no pain or problem, you're never going to sell. But if you don't have a motivation, well, then that is kind of, it needs to be there for the sale. So the analogy I give is, I've got one of those old cassette players in my car. It doesn't work. So I've got a problem. I've got a pain. But I actually just went and bought one of those fancy Bluetooth devices to kind of stream my phone. So I'm not going to go and buy a new car just because that's broken. So when it comes to uncovering motivation, have you found any techniques or ways to get to there?
Yeah. The way that you uncover the motivation is you have to be willing to ask maybe three why questions. I say that with some caution because people are not very good at asking why. And why is a dangerous question to ask, because it shows like you have authority over the other person. And the example would be like, why'd you go out last night? Why did you leave this here? It can sound accusatory. It sounds like you're in control and you have to be careful. Plus, why questions are very difficult to answer. Why did you have this conversation with me today? I mean, depending on how you ask in tonality and the person that you're talking to, it's quite difficult. But if we take it to Simon Sinek's thing where he's like, start with why, I think you need to end with why. Like, let's understand some of the pain point. Let's understand the scenarios, what you're going through. And if possible, I would ask you lots of what questions that would help me to understand the why without having you to figure it out on your own. So in the book, and this aligned with my philosophy on this, is when I ask you a question, I need to ask questions that you can answer. So they have to be constructed in a way that takes you logically through a series of decisions that you're going to make that feel pretty small and reasonable for you to be able to respond to. Like if I ask you this question, like when it's time for you to die, you're an old person laying in your bed, looking back on your life, what has been the most significant things? You could be like, I don't know, Chris, or what's the meaning of life? How do you define love? These could be horribly difficult things to answer. So what I need to do is scaffold towards that or chunk down the big why into easier bite-sized questions that you can answer. Through that process, what we do is we help the prospect get clarity on a problem, and they're going to feel a little lighter each time they take a step towards understanding what it is. And I find this to be strange. Without giving any advice, without prescribing any solutions, if I ask the right questions, you're going to attribute all the clarity to me. You're going to say, this was the best conversation I've ever had. Your ideas are amazing. And I look to myself like, I'll take the compliment, but I was thinking, I just ask questions. So in a weird way, I know there's not a real word, but we want to be great questionologists. And there's too much in our culture, in our education, that's baked into giving answers as opposed to asking really great, beautiful questions.
So, Chris, I love it, because we're all about we steal all of our sales techniques from therapy. So how do we use the Socratic method and all these different things to because you don't go into a therapist and they say, let me just tell you about where I went to school and kind of all these amazing things I've done in my life. They're like, no, let me just ask you. A lot of sellers will probably be struggling with tire kickers. We know that they exist. There are people out there that just want to sit down, probably especially with creatives, because actually if I sit down with 10 creatives and they give me, that's 10 hours of free consultancy, and I might not need to buy anything because they'll give me all this information. So budget, the right people, the timeline, all of those things, they're probably things that are worth ticking off and being wary of. But how do you guide creatives and entrepreneurs to find that information, probably using this Socratic method or other therapeutic techniques?
I love that you bring up therapy, because pound for pound, the amount of time and money I've spent on therapy has been some of the most instructive things in my life. Not only did I get help with my own problem, I got to see a master practitioner, what they do and how they do it, and use the frameworks that I can discern for myself and to sort of reverse engineer. It's been excellent. So whether you even have a thing you're going through, I would highly recommend everyone go to a really good, highly recommended therapist that they know in their network and spend a couple of sessions and watch how they ask you questions. And they're very logical in how they lead. They ask you for evidence. And those are kinds of things that I've learned from just, I guess, being in the other side of the chair. That's wonderful. Okay. Let me address a couple of the common problems that service professionals have. Usually one of the biggest ones is price. They're nervous to talk about money, and so they very rarely do, and they kick that conversation so far down that it actually doesn't happen on the call. It happens in the proposal process, and they have no idea what the number should be. They haven't established value. They don't know what the person feels is fair to pay, so it's a lot of just guessing in the dark. And if you leave a creative person alone in the dark long enough, they'll just charge zero. They'll just talk themselves out of it in the echo chamber of their mind, right? We see this happen all the time. So if you are in a position where several people are coming to you and you get to the money conversation and like, oh, this is too much money. And if you had it happen once, no problem. If it's happened to you more than once, it's your problem because you keep setting up something. So we got to look at how you're positioned in the marketplace. So perhaps you're shy to put out any pricing. You don't do any kind of social proof. And social proof could be as simple as, here are clients I've worked with before, here are the results we've gotten, and here's kind of what it looks like in a case study. When you do that, and you do that well, it creates this expectation like, my gosh, they've worked with X. I'm not as big as X. I probably can't even afford this, but I should talk to them because they're really good. And so some of that work is done for you. But should they arrive on the phone and you, for whatever reason, have scheduled without doing any kind of vetting and qualifying, you owe it to yourself to say this. And here's a question I would ask the prospect if they're on the phone. Oftentimes when I get on a call with a client like you, the issue of money eventually comes up. And they often will have sticker shock because they'll think it's one price when they discover I'm usually more expensive or a higher price than most of the people are going to talk to. So I want to save us both a lot of time. If your primary concern is price, then I'm not a good fit for you. Is that your concern? And they're like, you know, most people would hear that as, are you saying I'm cheap? Like I can't afford this? And so people want to prove you wrong. It's kind of a weird phenomenon. They're like, no, I can afford this. Okay, then we should continue the conversation, but let me just float a number out by you. For clients like you, for things like this, it's going to be somewhere between $10,000 to $20,000 or pounds. Are you still okay with that number? Feel free to say no. And then just pause and let them process that. Here's one thing. Here's a quick tip for people. When we say things that might cause some discomfort for the other person or more for ourselves, we want to like not have any silence happen. So we'll say something like that and then we'll just run right over it because we're just uncomfortable with any slight friction. And I'm going to tell you right now, silence is your friend. So you're going to ask a question like that and you're just going to be very still. Just look in your most stoic face and just look at them and just be quiet. If it takes 30 seconds for them to say something, you just wait. Read their face, read their body language, and the next words that come out of their mouth will be the most telling piece of information that you have. I'll give you an example. If they stammer a little bit when they say, like, no, I think I'm okay with that price, that is not the truth. So I heard this recently, okay? Which is, the truth is very easy to say, lies are very difficult. And here's why. It's because, and I don't know if this is true, but I think there's some science behind this. The body lives in reality. It's only the mind that lives in imagination. So when there's a conflict between the mind and the body, we see things like this. We'll see some shuffling. So if somebody says yes, and they shake their head like, yes, I'd like to move forward. The truth is the body, not what you hear. So when you look for those little tells, these little signs, you'll notice something and you should address it. You just say, okay, I just want to double check because it sounded like you were a little hesitant with that price point. Tell me more about what you're feeling. What were your expectations? And they'll say something like, yeah, I guess you picked up on that, huh? I was thinking this could probably maximum what I could spend is like $8,000. Now you got a valuable piece of information and you could decide what you want to do here. And so I have to begin that conversation with them so that we're both talking about the same thing. Now that we got the money stuff set aside. Let's focus on why we're having this conversation. So of all the people you wanted to talk to, tell me a little bit more about what it is that compelled you to have this conversation with me today. You can start something like that.
So how do you find it best to, so if there are, if people are recoiling at the price and you've got to call it out, obviously we don't want, we want to be therapists. We don't want to be used car salespeople.
Yeah.
We don't want to like just go bluntly for it. How do you find it best to handle those difficult conversations or ask difficult questions? Because we know that everything good in life is on the other end of a difficult conversation.
Right. So there's potentially like three options here, right? If they're good with the price, we don't have to worry about that right now. Like if it's a genuine, I got this, don't worry, I have the budget to do what's necessary, this is a high priority for me. It's actually the highest priority for me. And I've allocated the time, the resources to do this properly. And I prefer to work with someone who's a professional like yourself. Great. Those are easy. We don't get those very often. The no's are also very easy. The maybes are the difficult ones to deal with. If they're like, no, Chris, I have $500. And then I would end the call. I would say, well, that's fantastic. I'm sure you can find someone to do it for that. I just can't do it. And so what would be most helpful to you right now? Should I try and find a recommendation? Like, yeah, that would be great. Or I don't want to waste any more of your time. So here's where it gets real interesting again. Some people, the business people that call you, are more shrewd at negotiations than you are. Let's accept that, okay? Because they have the money, you don't. That's usually how it works. So when you're the buyer, you're more savvy in business usually than the person that you're hiring, typically, not always. And so you have to just know that they're pretty savvy with negotiations. What they've just done now is like, I only had $500, is they price reverse price anchored you right now. So you're sitting there thinking, I want a 10 to 20K. They're saying 500. Maybe I should ask for 1500 now. So it's just, it's a negotiations and it's a game. And I want you to think of this as a game. It's not life and death. Nothing will change dramatically with your health after this. Okay, you might feel a little bit more stressed out. But other than that, nothing. So if they say $500, then you say, okay, wow, so this is probably not a good idea. And then this is where it gets real interesting. Then they will say, wait, hold on a second. I might be able to go up much more, but it would depend on what you have to say. Okay, then they're re-engaging. So here's the thing. I always have in my mind the exit door really close to me. And anytime I feel like they need to exit, I'm like, by the way, that's the door. But I say that with, you know, like in a polite professional manner, I'm like, get the hell out of here. I just say, maybe this is not a good fit. And then they're like, no, close the door, Chris. I'm still in this. And we keep checking with them. In the book, The Win Without Pitching Manifesto, Blair Enns writes about this. He goes, we should practice this concept. And he gives it a term. He says, retreat and follow. We test the prospect's willingness to work with us by taking a half step back to see if they'll follow us. And by leading them through these little half step backs, we realize they're very engaged. And the metaphor would work something like this. I love fishing, right? So when I cast a line out in the water and you see the little floater and it's bobbling, the rookie wants to grab the pole and yank on it real fast, thinking it's going to hook the fish and then we're good. And what happens most of the time is you pull the hook or the bait right out of the fish's mouth. What's happening is fish are quite smart. They don't fully commit to the bite. What they do is they kind of push water or air at it, and then they test it to see, is this a bait that I can attack or not? And they might cup it in its mouth and just gently nibble at it, but they're not really on it. So what you want to do is you want to create a little tension in the line, take the slack out, and make sure that fish is really on there before you go ahead and set the hook. And so there's a lot of like analogies between fishing and sales, I think, that I can hopefully make it make sense for a lot of folk, right? So in that process, you're like, maybe I'll let you go. And they're like, no, hold on. I'm still interested. Hold on. There's something very compelling, mysterious about you. You're the first person I've talked to in a week that isn't desperate for my business. Okay. Well, what would you do for $8,000? Can anything be done, Chris? I'm like, well, something can be done. Let's look at this. It warrants a deeper conversation. That puts them into the maybe category. So in the maybe category, we're trying to determine if they're a no pretending to be a maybe, which could be a big time suck, or a yes, but a little reluctant. And we have to be deeply empathetic with the person because whatever amount of money they're spending, it doesn't matter how little it is, no one wants to waste money. Like when you go out to the store and you want to buy a $25, I don't know, book or something, you still don't want to waste money. You read the cover, you read the reviews, and if you buy a stupid book for $25, you feel like an idiot. If you add a couple of zeros to that, that's what's at stake for the other person. So oftentimes we just look at it from our POV and say, well, they're so stupid, they should buy this thing from me. When in fact, when you're in the other shoes, you exercise a lot of due diligence and caution. So you need to be empathetic to the other person and think about how they're feeling.
Mm, I love that. So then one of the things that's always going to come up, like you've kind of touched on it there with the budget, and I thought the framework was beautiful, but like objections. I'd be keen to understand not just necessarily how like you would go about handling objections, but what you truly believe is an objection. Because I hear people say, oh, they said this objection. I'm like, is that an objection? Is that a question? Is that a statement? Is that a knee-jerk reaction? What's your take, Chris, on objections?
Okay. In an ideal world, you both get on the call, you have an offer and they have a need or a problem, and you just buy it. They just buy it, right? Like there's zero friction. It's a straight line from A to B. That's it. In reality, it's never like that. So to me, an objection sounds like this. It sounds like some resistance to actually moving to the next step. You could hear in the voice, in a pregnant pause, something like that, a discomfort, like in them scratching their neck. You could see it. You can feel it if you're paying attention. And anything that creates resistance needs to be addressed. Otherwise, it starts to fester and grow. It's like, did they not realize I'm not ready to move forward? And they're just going on to steps B, C, and D. And you're going out of rapport, whereas you want to be in rapport. Where most creative professionals respond to objections is they look at them as insults, like, how dare you ask me a question about the price or what you're going to get or whatever it is. And they have a really negative response to that. So the reframe here is to think of objections as an indicator of interest, an IOI, an indicator of interest. And I'll tell you why. We've all been in a situation before where we're at the store or someone's trying to sell us something and we're thinking, this is stupid, I want out. We don't usually stay engaged in the conversation anymore. So somebody's like, are you interested? Nope. You just walk away. If somebody comes up to you and says, are you interested? You're like, well, tell me more about that. I'm not sure I need that. It's because you're really interested. Like, you might be able to convince me right now. I never thought of it that way. So when someone says to you anything that might create some resistance in them saying yes, you need to address it and address it in a Socratic way. Ask more questions. Okay. So let's step into role play, Jack.
I'm ready.
What's a common objection that somebody might share with you or you've experienced yourself?
The commitment is too long. We'd never work with somebody for 6 months.
Okay. What is more comfortable for you? What feels like the right amount of commitment?
It's probably anywhere between 1 and 3 months.
Okay. Ideally, where would it be?
Three months.
That sounds fairly reasonable. Okay. Based on that, what part of this engagement can we hit at the 3 month mark, which will make you feel like you've gotten a good result?
Well, if you've achieved X amount of results by the 3 month mark, then well, I'd know it was working.
Okay. That sounds pretty reasonable. So if I were able to present a solution to you, and I'm not sure if I can, but I'm going to go back and think on this, where we can hit the X result that we talked about in 3 months, 90 days or less, that would that make you feel more comfortable?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd definitely feel more comfortable that way.
Okay. And if that were possible, is there anything else that would give you reservation or pause as to moving forward?
No, I think that would be the main thing.
Okay. And then that's how we would deal with that, just with more questions. Okay. Yeah.
Well, would you then where would you go with that, Chris? Would you say, right, we're going to go away and change it? Or say there was, say, for people listening that have got a boss and they go, actually, the boss isn't going to budge on that. What's the next move from there?
Okay. Then we have to then use the give get principle. When we give them something, we have to get something back. It's give get. And I'll tell you why that's important. Sometimes when we say a price and it's really high, and then they chop it in half in terms of the budget, and we're like, okay, I could do for that. When you agree to that, the person is going to think something different than what you're thinking. You're thinking, I just made a huge concession. I'm agreeing to do this for half the budget. What the other person is thinking, this person was trying to rip me off. They folded like a chair or deck of cards, and I didn't even push back that hard. I wonder if I can get it for even less, or if I can ask for more. it's really weird how human psychology works, right? Because when you agree almost without any resistance to reducing the price by a significant amount of money without changing the scope, it signals to me like, wow, had I not asked that, you would have just raked me over the coals on this one. Wow, I'm not sure if I want to trust you at this point in time. So when we give something, we have to get something back. So you can say something like, I can't give you everything we talked about for half the budget, but I can give you this instead under certain conditions. Like there's only one round of revision, that we only give you rights to use the work for the region and not globally. And instead of a 4-year term, it's a 1-year term. Can you live with that? And oftentimes most people will say yes, because they didn't want all that extra stuff. Now, a lot of this is mostly psychological and philosophical because, you know, are you going to be able to check up on them in a year? Probably not. But it's important that you ask for a concession. And in fact, you can ask for a concession before there's any negotiation, which is really interesting. It'll show you how engaged they are in wanting to work with you. I'll give you an example. Okay. I can say something on the very beginning of the call. I say, hey, Jack, I don't want to waste your time. I know we were potentially going to talk about working together, but I just need to let you know my calendar is not going to be open for another 2 months. Is that something that you can wait for? And you'll probably say no, but you might say yes. That's a concession right away. Do you really want to work with me that badly that you're willing to wait 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years? Notice how some restaurants, the wait list is 6 months long. That's a concession they're all asking us. Some restaurants do not take reservations. They want you to wait outside in a line. I hate that, but I still show up. That's a concession. And you know why they do that? It's great marketing. Because whenever you see a line, you think this must be really good.
I love that. I love that. I think the give-get thing is brilliant. And I think it's, there's so much. It's quite nice the way the conversations go. We're walking through the sales process. So I want to ask you about closing for everybody that believes that they're a younger Jordan Belfort and has different closes. I'm sure there's variations out there. I would say, and I might be wrong, but I would say that creatives, like we found with the budget thing, they might struggle to ask for the business. When we do sales training or consultancy, one of the questions we ask is, are your sales rep asking for the business at the end? Is there that bit where they not try and hard close or they push somebody into a 6-year contract? Are they just asking for the business? So when it comes to closing and next steps, where would you take that?
We're all aware of these like really fun diagrams, a decision tree, where it says, are you this kind of fan or that kind of fan? And then it starts to go down and you eventually land up like, oh, you're this kind of character in the Game of Thrones or something like that. Let's just say it's something like that. Well, I imagine in my mind the conversation to be something like that. There's a bunch of little decisions that are being made. The decision tree isn't like a literal formula or a framework. It's just how we're processing. So it starts all a little bit broad. We revisit the past. We talk about your goals, how you measure success, what the value of achieving this result is to you. We'll define what feels like a fair price. And then now we have to kind of lead them to the next step. Here's the funny thing. When I hire creative people, they never talk about price. They don't tell me what the next steps are. They do not ask for a business, and I'm not going to help them. I'm just not going to help them, because I was thinking, you're going to have to be strong enough to say this. Otherwise, I'm getting off this call and you're going to stress out, and I'll let you stress out. It's not my job to do your job for you. And so this might describe a lot of creative people. They just don't want to ask for the business, mostly because they're afraid of rejection. Like hearing no is so painful for people that they will never ask a question that they can hear no to. And that's one of the biggest problems. So the first thing before I get into how you might do this is to practice some form of rejection therapy. I guess it's a modern concept where you go out and you ask for things that you know they're going to say no to. And the example comes from, like, I think it was a TED Talk that I saw. In a lot of places, you know, like fast food, fast casual, you can ask for drink refills, like, can you top off my tea or my coffee? They're happy to do that. But what they say in the rejection therapy is ask for a burger refill. Like, say, I finished my burger. Can I get a refill of the burger? And they're like, what? No, you can't have that. And you're like, okay. And go up to a stranger and say, can I have $100 or £100? And they'll say no. And what's going to happen to you is you're going to become desensitized to hearing no. All of your fears around hearing no will start to slowly disappear. At first, it's going to feel super uncomfortable, but eventually it won't, and you won't be afraid to ask for that. So that's a practical tip. Let's get into the framework now. You've established what they want, how they're going to measure success, and you go through this whole process, so you're kind of narrowing the conversation down. And if so far, all the indicators point towards yes, like this is a good opportunity for us to work together, then you must be able to close. Here's the thing, don't do this. I remember speaking at a conference or doing a workshop, and some of the people were helping me to organize it after the end of the workshop. She walked right up to me and she said this thing, super direct, she's European. She's like, so when are you gonna hire me? I was so off put by that, I'm like, I didn't even know what to say. I'm like, it's like, why would you blindside me on that one? A, I didn't know you were looking for a job. B, I didn't know I was hiring. And what a weird, uncomfortable way to approach somebody and ask them such a direct yes or no kind of thing. So I just kind of gave them a nervous laugh. And I was like, what? And later on, I'm like, did you know she was going to ask me for a job? And they're like, no, it came out of nowhere. So there was no scaffolding there. That's the problem. So what we realize is when we hold someone to a yes or no decision, they're more likely going to say no because they want to feel like they're in control and they have power. And so here's where we go. We ask them a hypothetical close. And it's a good concept. So what we do is say, we say something like, imagine if or if, because that's hypothetical. Like if you were given $1 million, Jack, what would you spend money on? And you would be able to answer that. And if you didn't have to work ever again, what would you do? And if you weren't married right now, where would you travel to? You can answer all those questions. But if I asked it in a kind of a positive sense where I say, are you willing to leave your wife or your husband or whoever? You're like, what? I'm not going to do that. Why would I do that? Because it feels like you're making a commitment at that point. Mm. But if takes away some of the commitment and it makes it a little easier for you to think about. Something like, there's a poet who wrote something about this where like hypothetical questions open the doors to imagination and we live in imagination, something like that. I've totally butchered that, but it was good when I read it, okay? All right, so we're gonna say something like this. So Jack, let me see if I get this right. If you got a solution that did X, Y, and Z within the 3 months that we talked about for the price point of $12,700, that's the price point we're talking about, would you be willing to move forward? And you would say?
Yeah, of course, Chris. Anything.
See, the way you said that, that had conviction in it. You're like, yes, of course, you mother effer. Of course, that's what we've been talking about this whole time. So now I know, okay. So then I say, okay, great. So I'll go away. I'll work on a proposal for that amount. It'll be in your inbox by first thing tomorrow. Can you make a decision in the next, say, 48 hours after receiving it?
Yeah, of course. That's fair.
Okay. And now, before I get off the phone, is there any other reason why you would hesitate to move forward since we've already talked about everything? Is there anything that we've missed?
No, you've nailed it.
Okay, perfect. And I might ask one other thing. It's called like addressing the ghost in the room, which is sometimes people have to consult with their partners, their professional and their personal partners. Like you might have to talk to your husband or your wife and say, hey, I'm going to spend this kind of money. You cool with that? So then I would say, is there anybody else that's important in making this decision that would have pause or concern? And then you would say yes or no, and then we would get into that. Mm. Now we know, and then I can go away now building a proposal, knowing the exact number I need to land on in order for you to say yes.
I love the closing style. The proposal piece, so you might really show me up here. Obviously, I run a sales agency. Mm-hmm. People, we have conversations. We don't send proposals because I'm of the school of thought that a proposal would be going out, doing a lot of free work, a lot of consultancy. I've definitely coached and worked with marketing agencies and creative agencies, and it's like you can actually just remove a lot of the proposal work because people are just going straight to pricing. How does somebody nail a proposal? What's your take on it all?
Okay. Ideally, the proposal is one page. And the proposal is just a summary of the things we've already talked about. And I don't want you to think about the scope or the number the first time when you see it on a piece of paper. I want us to have a dialogue around it. So this entire time we're building the proposal together in our mind, in conversation. And then I send that piece of paper to make sure there's no misunderstanding. I don't want people to send 35 page proposals where they're like saying, now here's the direction, here's the strategy, here's the positioning. I've done a free audit for you. First of all, that's just too much work. More often than not too, it's too much work this early because the person who looks at this is going to be overwhelmed with what you're doing. And that kind of processing power that they have to go through a multi-page deck like that is going to then push it to the bottom of their inbox. So it's kind of counterintuitive. The more work you do up front without getting paid for it, the less likely the client's going to be committed and the less value they're going to assign to it. They're going to say, well, they only did this in a couple of days and I didn't pay him anything. It must not be valuable. When in fact, all of your best ideas, the reflection of your many years or sometimes decades of experience are translated into this document and you just threw it kind of in the trash. I would not do that. In fact, I've been in situations multiple times where in order to meet with a person, they send you an RFP, a request for a proposal, and you have to show up with an idea with a plan. Okay? And this has worked out and it's not worked out for me in both ways. I get on the phone with them. I said, your project sounds intriguing. I'd love to be considered for this, but we don't send out ideas without having conversations and before we're engaged. Doesn't make sense. Are you cool with us giving you a capabilities deck? And they say yes or no, and we send it. And then they look through that work and like, this is interesting work. Let's have a meeting. Then during the meeting, they'll try and pull a fast one. They'll say, so what are your ideas on this? So part of our work process means that we have to spend time in dialogue with the clients, facilitating a discovery session where we learn more about their pain points and their challenges and who their ideal customers are. Then we explain that one more time. They either make a decision, yes or no. And so doing it this way, we've already asked for a concession before we've ever met with a client. I'm going to derail the pitch process right now. They're asking you for free ideas. I don't do that. Okay. And that one project started out as a $100,000 RFP, turned into over $1 million of new business for us over a period of 2 years. It was awesome. They were giving us all kinds of projects nonstop. Same kind of situation, did the exact same dialogue, showed up to the meeting. And I was in a room with like 6 or 7 executives. And they're like, Chris, what are your ideas? I looked at him like, am I in the wrong meeting? I thought I was clear with... He goes, oh, yeah. Right. So I said, do you want to cancel the meeting? He goes, no, just go over whatever you have. I'm like, okay, I have my capabilities deck. I'm about to walk him through it. I get 1 minute into it, like, no, let's just stop. Let's kill this meeting. I said, okay. He shook his hand, never talked to him ever again. Got in the car and left. Wasted my time. I'll tell you why this is not a loss. A person who says one thing and acts differently is not someone you want as a client. I don't care how much money's at the other end of that. They're going to abuse you. They're going to take advantage of you. They might even pay you. And the worst part is they might sue you. This is not a person I want to do business with. So when they break their own agreement, I'm out.
And the first example, I think the first story with the RFP, yeah. That's like a great example of when everybody's zigging and they're putting their proposals in or they're tendering and you're the guy right. That's saying, actually, no, we don't do anything. Well, actually, I want a slice of that. I want to work with that guy because that's the way the psychology works. You make it all sound so simple, Chris. I know that salespeople will be listening to this going, why have I missed this for so long? Mm. You spoke about rejection and like rejection sensitivity, and then it felt like we touched on it earlier, but you brushed over it. I'd love to really just like end on this note for people: detachment from the outcome. There'll be people listening thinking they're a young Marcus Aurelius ready to go and hit the phones. How do you actually detach from the outcome when it comes to selling?
That's a very good thing. Okay, so this is a larger kind of life philosophy. Maybe it's like part of Stoicism or Zen Buddhism, where we can sit there and say, the more attached we are to something, the more difficult it becomes for us to make a clear decision. This is the reason why doctors are not allowed to work on family members. because they don't make good decisions. They know this. And so if your family members get hurt, you might be the world's best surgeon, but they will not let you work on your own family. And we always see this in kind of wartime movies where someone's trapped in the back of the submarine and the captain is the captain who has to make the tough decision. Do we let six of our crewmen die or do we all perish risking our lives for this? And they seem like they're cold and calculated. And that's what it's going to look like from the outside. And you're going to see the other, like the first officer or the other crew say, "Captain, we have to do everything we can save them." And basically have 10 seconds to make the right decision. And maybe the right decision in this is there's no right decision. It's just what kind of loss are we willing to deal with, right? And so in order to be in a position like that, you have to practice detachment where there's no expectations of outcome. And the reason why is because when we're on a call and we say to ourselves before the call happens, this is the most amazing client. This client's going to change the game. I'm going to make my numbers. I'm going to do this, this, and that. And we're living in the future again. So we get on the call and we all of a sudden, we've put ourselves at a disadvantage because we want this so bad. And in negotiations, whoever wants it less has the upper hand. And I would think you should strive for at least being equal or have the slight upper hand. And if you want it more than they want it, you're not going to be able to negotiate, and you're going to listen with happy ears. You're going to hear what you want to hear, and you're not going to be able to hear an objection or resistance. And when you're out of rapport, you're going to be thinking, this is awesome. And when they're thinking, I can't wait to get off this call. It's really important. So the way we look at this is something like this. Your life was going along and it continues to move along this path. And then there's an opportunity. And what happens is we think the timeline splits in half. Whereas if we get the opportunity, our lives change and everything's much better. So we would rather live on that timeline than our current timeline. But I want to ask you this question. What if the client just canceled the call prior to getting on it? Your life continues on. And I've been in business long enough, almost 3 decades now, where some of the biggest projects with the biggest budgets, I thought, this is going to change the game. This is it. This is our ticket where we get to like have a blank check and we get to do whatever we want from this point forward. And sad to say, you have these momentary spikes and your life goes right back to the original timeline. And again, because nothing in life is guaranteed. Because you've done X doesn't mean you get to do Y. And so if we can practice this form of detachment, of stoicism, if you're not familiar with that word, I will look it up. And Ryan Holiday's written a book or two about this idea. I think it's from the three Stoics. Marcus Aurelius is probably the most well-known. Seneca, and I forget the other person. But it's an idea in Western philosophy that you see things for the way they are and not for the way that you want them to be. The example from the book, The Obstacle is the Way, is something like this. Marcus Aurelius would do this all the time. He would say something like, fine wine is rotting grapes. And like some kind of like veal chop or some like prime rib is just a carcass of an animal. And he wants to decode all this romantic words that we would attach to things. Like, this is going to be the game-changing client. It's a prospect. And so if we can learn to strip away the judgment and the value assignment to things, I think we're going to see things much clearer. And it's going to give you a lot of power. I'm going to give you one quick example here. I have a small team of creatives, and they're usually doing the client interfacing stuff. All of them are trained by me before they're allowed to talk to clients, right? So the first they shadow me, and then they do their thing. And eventually, they either are good enough to do the calls, or they need to find a different job. Luckily, most of them are good enough to do the call. I remember one time, one of my guys, he comes running into my office, and he goes, "Chris, oh my God, this client." I'm like, "What's wrong?" It's like, "Do you know who they are?" I'm like, "I know who they are. What does that mean?" "Well, this is who I've always wanted to work in my life. And the kind of money we're talking about here, it's like over $500,000. So take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. I want you to remember what your life was like before this client reached out. Go back to that place. We're going to be fine with them. We're going to be fine without them. Daniel Priestley calls this the with or without you energy. And some people have said, "Chris, you have that kind of energy." I'm like, "Okay, if you want to call it that, whatever you want to say." It's like, my life continues on. And it always does. It's our attachment to some future state that hasn't happened yet. Or it's an attachment to the past of our old glory days that really messes us up from being present in the moment. We're going to be okay either way. And you know what? there's something that's really disarming that the other person will feel. Like, this guy or gal doesn't give a rat's balls if we work with them. They're not sitting here treating us and blowing smoke up our butt. Like, they're going to say the truth. So in that moment, I told him, everything's going to be okay. But I'll tell you what's not going to be okay. If you go on that call and you're like all huffing and puffing and hyper-energized and it's desperate to close it, you won't be using all of your brain. You'll sound desperate. And desperate people are pretty repulsive. And I'll land it on this one example, okay? So one of these clients, it was for a logo assignment that was going to be more money than we've ever been paid for just designing a logo. It was over $100,000. And my creative director was interfacing with their VP for days or over the course of 2 weeks to make sure we're a good fit. Now it was CEO to CEO time, and they're a really big corporation, $200-300 million in revenue a year. We get on the phone, and I'm prone to do this. I barely do any preparation, and my creative director's got all the notes. He's ready to go. We get on the call, and we're talking about something, and the CEO asked me personally, he's like, Chris, have you been to our site? Do you know what we do? I said, I haven't. I don't. He goes, okay. I said, I knew we were going to have this conversation. Sometimes it's dangerous for me to come in with ideas that aren't from your mouth. He's like, okay. And we have a conversation, 20 minutes or so. We hang up the call or the phone. Dude, why did you do that? I'm like, do what? I thought the call went really well. We were in rapport. He goes, I knew all this stuff. You could have just thrown it to me. I said, there's a problem with that. When a person asked me a point blank question, he didn't say, did you guys? He said, Chris, did you personally look at this and you understand what we do? I have to tell him the truth. So he's like, oh, dude, weeks worth of preparation for this and you've just blown it. I don't think so. Let's see what happens. A couple days later, he comes back in my room all excited. He's like, we got the gig and we're doing the work for them. And now we get to know them better. Why did we get the gig? He says, because the CEO asked your boss a direct question and this guy doesn't lie. He respects that.
Chris, I love this conversation. And I really don't say this lightly. This has been one of my favorite conversations. We've been doing this for over 3 years. This has been brilliant. I think it's action-packed. I think there are certain conversations that you want to listen to again because there's so much that you'll take away. So thank you for sharing that with me and the audience. For people that want to work with you, find you, I know that you're on a mission. What should they be doing, Chris?
Okay. If you want to come hang out, learn with me in person, I do speak throughout all over the world. And there's something that's coming up and I'd love to see you if you're on that side of the world. I'm going to be speaking or running a series of workshops in Singapore in June. I don't know when this episode is going to come out, but it's the first week of June. And you can find that if you reach out to me. I'm on almost every social platform. I answer all my own DMs. So if you want to reach out and you want to talk to me, keep it short, but I'll be there. I'm at the Chris Doe, D-O. And that's on Instagram, LinkedIn, X, YouTube. What am I missing? TikTok. I think that's most of them.
You're everywhere.
I'm everywhere.
You're everywhere.
Fashionably dressed, so I might add.
Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jack.